today's case show will be on case 42 in the Mumonkan, the gate of no barrier. The girl comes out of samadhi. Once, in the old days, in the time of the World Honored One, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained, sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers once, took her up to Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of her meditation, but in vain. The World Honored One said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up." But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva Momyo. He will be able to arouse her from her samadhi. Instantly, the Bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the World Honored One, who gave him his orders. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. Mumon's comment: old Shakyamuni put a petty drama on the stage and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. Mumon's verse: one was successful, the other was not. Both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil mask. Even in defeat, a beautiful performance. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to usher in the new year. This is a wonderful way to bring 2005 to a close and to prepare ourselves for 2006. And I had a wonderful sit this morning. I have been working on, I'm an English teacher and I also work at a university, so I have to deal with many different jobs. I teach, I have an administrative position, and also I'm a scholar and I write, you know, articles. So I have had the last week, an opportunity to do some of my writing and research work, and it's been a challenge for me. In fact, it's always a challenge. I guess that if you're a lawyer, you have days where you walk into the courtroom and you say, "I really love law. I love the law." But I'm sure as you walk into the courtroom, sometimes you have moments where you think, "Oh God, you know, what's going to happen today at this trial?" If you're a doctor, you know, you must say, I love medicine. I love being a doctor. But, you know, if you have a difficult case, or if you have, maybe you're a surgeon, you know, you must, on the way into the operating room, you must think, oh man, I don't know. I guess everybody has those feelings. And I have to tell you that I've been writing all my life. It's one of the main things I do in my job. And it's always difficult and challenging. It's never easy or straightforward, at least for me. I think there are people who write easily and sit down and knock out 20 pages, but I'm not one of those people. So for me, every day is a real challenge when I'm writing. I sit down and I write all day. You know, I get up and I sit, meditate. I might go for a jog, and then I start working. And usually in the afternoon I'll read something, and the next day I'll be using what I read to develop the article or the book chapter that I'm working on. And the thing is, you know, you can write one day and you're sort of white hot. It just comes pouring out on the page. You think, this is it, you know, I'm a genius. You get up the next day and you read it and think, oh man, this is really junk. So into the trash it goes. Or, you know, really now you just delete it on your computer. But you start again. You work all day. Next day you get up and you read what you wrote and you realize, oh, that's a mistake. I have to read. So it's not easy. And it's often sort of tense. Believe it or not, because you're writing a lot and you're developing a line of thinking, but you don't know where it's really going to go, and you don't know if it's ever going to see the light of day. You know, I could spend 3 months writing something, and I could send it off, and somebody would just reject it. So all of this is going on while I'm writing, and I love to work through these ideas. I really love it. But I often feel a little bit like the lawyer going into the courtroom or the doctor going into the operating room. You know, you're wondering, is any of this going to work out? Is this, you know, the longer you work on a project like this, the higher the stakes get. If you've written a book for, say, 3 years, which is quite easy to do, actually, the more time and energy you invest in your argument, the more energy you put in. And it takes so much work to say something intelligent. You know, when you sit down to read an article in a magazine, you might read it in 30 minutes. But it might have taken that person months to write that, to research and write that. And every sentence for me is kind of a struggle, getting the sentence properly balanced, clear, saying what I want to say. All of this, it seems as though, for me, writing, say, 4 pages, that's a good day. And if I can get 4 pages out, I've really done a good job. And then I go back and revise at the end of the day, and it's like sentence by sentence. It's a little bit like crawling over broken glass sometimes. It just seems interminable. And I love it, but it's difficult. And I've been doing this intensely all week. And so I came in here and I sat down and just had this wonderful sit. It's like all of these phantoms, all of these fears and anxieties, all of these ideas that have been sort of troubling me, you know, is it this way or is it that way? All of this is sort of dispelled this morning, it's just blown away. And sitting on the cushion, I just felt so wonderful. It's so refreshing for me, and it's so wonderful because I feel like I'm back in touch with reality. You know, the world of ideas is interesting and exciting, but it's like entering a maze or a labyrinth. You know, you just wander around and. I have to confess that in this article I've been working on, I've been reading this German thinker named Hegel. If you ever have had the pleasure of reading Mr. Hegel, let me just say that he's unbearable. There's a school of thinking called German idealism. And these people were incredibly abstract thinkers and incredibly unclear writers. And I've been rereading this stuff, and it's like a form of mental illness, really, I think. Really, they're like insane, almost. And so just coming in here and sitting down and being in the moment is so therapeutic. I feel so stable and happy and calm again. I'm so glad I did this. It seems to me that many people could benefit from what we're doing. I meet people all the time who are pretty unhappy very troubled. I mean, you don't have to go far to run into such people. They're all around us. And sometimes because I teach meditation, people come and talk to me, and they'll say, you know, I'm even not necessarily people who sit. They'll come to see me and they'll tell me this is happening in my life, and you know, do you have any thoughts? And I'll say, well, why don't you come to sit? And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. But you know, the world is full of very unhappy people. Very troubled, frightened, fearful people. And at the same time, you know, we seem to have a quite unrealistic image of ourselves. I think people imagine that human beings are basically sane, basically happy, basically well-adjusted, and so on and so on. And this is really quite far from the truth, it seems to me. Really very, very far. We have this very unrealistic image of ourselves. I have neighbors who know what I do. And recently, my wife and I went to a party in our neighborhood. And somebody was curious about meditation practice, and I said, oh yes, you know, I get up every day and I meditate for at least an hour, usually an hour and a half or 2 hours, and I talked about the sitting schedule that we have, and often I'll get people will be just astounded. They'll say, my God, you do a lot of meditation, and they just seem astounded. It's like, my God, that's a there's a slight element of amazement, and it's almost like ridicule a little bit, you know. It's like, you really do a lot of meditation. Kriti was telling me that she was listening to an interview with a meditation teacher, very famous, well-known meditation teacher in, he's very well-known in India. He's actually a yoga teacher. And he was being interviewed by somebody like Leonard Lopate on WNYC, which I listen to also. And Lopate said, well, what is your typical day? And he said, I get up at 4:30 in the morning and I do yoga. And Lopate said, how long? And the guy said, oh, you know, 4 or 5 hours. And Lopate almost, you know, he started laughing, like, you're kidding. It's like, that's insane, right? You know, and I think he did say something like, well, then, you know, what do you do after that? You know, because the day's pretty much shot. And I often get this reaction myself. The Dalai Lama, you might, I've mentioned many times, the last time I read something about his personal life, he does 4 hours of meditation every day. And a person could say, well, why? You know, what a waste of life, you know. And I think that people who feel that way are, of course, free to do whatever they want. But I think it reflects a very unrealistic view of human beings. And a very unrealistic view. I mean, first of all, I don't believe that there's anything so wild about doing a couple of hours of meditation every day, even 4 or 5 hours. I was reading an article that somebody sent me from Salon magazine. I don't know if you ever read salon.com. But there was an article, it was a movie review, the year in movies, and somebody was bringing my attention to a movie. And it was and also the same person had written the year in television. And her name is Heather, I can't remember her last name, but she writes regularly. And anyway, she laid out her favorite TV shows, and she said, at the end of the article, she said, there, that'll give you 20 good hours of viewing every week. And I suppose there's nothing odd about 20 good hours of television viewing every week, but there's something a little bit odd about doing meditation every day. See, this is sort of the way our culture thinks. But it seems to me that this reflects a very unrealistic image of the human being. I feel that humans are not as sane as they think they are. I just think it's true. Usually, we define sane in terms of what everybody else does, right? I mean, that's, as we grow up, we learn to make a distinction between our inner lives, sort of our inner mental life, and the public life. This is part of growing up. So we learn that there are some things you don't share with other people, right? You know, so when I sometimes I have to lead a meeting, a staff meeting, for all the people who work in the writing program, which I direct. And, you know, I wouldn't say, when we start the staff meeting, I wouldn't start out by saying, well, I want to thank you all for coming. You know, I've had the flu, and I hope I don't throw up right now or something like that. Generally, that would be something you would keep to yourself, right? You know, when President Bush is delivering a speech, he wouldn't pause and say, you know, I'm having a hard time giving the rest of my speech because I forgot to go to the bathroom before I came in. So we learn that there's actually a whole host of mental events that we don't share with other people. And we gradually learn that these are the things that we should share with others. So when I come in to have my staff meeting, I should say to each person, how's it going? You know, and people are really not going to tell me, oh, I forgot to go to the bathroom. They're going to say, oh, it's good. Everything's good, you know. So we learn how to live in a kind of publicly shared world, and this is what we call normal life. This is the normal world, right? And we go along to get along, right? This is how we live. You don't know any better as you're a little kid, and you're gradually learning that this is what's said, and this is what you keep locked up in your head, and this is what people do, and so you do it. And we have an image of this public world as being real and normal and sane, and generally it seems to be, we allow ourselves to think that way until something happens that makes us sort of realize that it's not so sane. And these can be minor events, or they can be really terrible events. You know. I'm always amazed at things like, when we look at extreme cases, you know, you could look at something like the rise of Nazi Germany, Or you could look at Stalin's Russia. And these are societies which were filled with apparently rational people that began to behave in ways that became more and more obviously irrational. Many of Hitler's followers, for example, were very well educated. Probably the most famous German philosopher in the 20th century, a man named Heidegger, about whom I've talked before because he's caused me so much misery in trying to understand what he wrote. You know, actually was a big backer of Hitler, and so were many German intellectuals. These were people who got up every day and read philosophy and prided themselves on their rationality, but their society began to become, you know, from our perspective, we would look at it and say, this is truly insane. But, it's very hard to see that if you're just going along to get along. You just do what everybody else does. And it's only at the extreme cases that we begin to notice that, our view of humans may be a little too optimistic. It's just the way it is. Little too optimistic. Maybe it's just necessary for us to clean up our mental house every day. Now, that's not so drastic. I mean, maybe that's part of the normal hygiene required for the care and maintenance of a human being. The idea that I can watch 20 hours of TV, and I can drink heavily, and I can do this and that, be happy, be sane. Maybe that's an unrealistic expectation. I personally feel that humans need to do more work on themselves than they realize. And you don't have to wait for the Third Reich to erupt. You just have to deal with people every day. And as I say, you don't have to look far or look very hard to see people who are unhappy, screwed up, frightened, cruel. It's all over the place. And it's important not to have too negative a view of humans either. But it is the case that it's probably a little harder than we normally suppose to be sane and happy and compassionate and so on. It takes a little more work than we might imagine. It's not just there automatically. And in fact, it's I think the case that humans have to work really fairly hard to be happy, healthy, mentally, compassionate. So it actually takes a fair amount of work because we have these tendencies. We have these tendencies, and we have to sort of see them for what they are. In some traditions, there's this idea that people are basically sinful. So in Judaism, you have an event like Moses going up onto the mountain to commune, basically to commune with God, right? And he's going up to meet with God, the creator of the universe, and to find out how to live properly. And he has this encounter with God and receives the Ten Commandments. And then he comes back down and he says, this is just wonderful. We figured out how to live. This will help us to be kind, compassionate, And he gets to the bottom of the mountain and everybody's, beating each other up and, cruel and selfish. And it's like, oh my gosh, a lot of work ahead, right? So, that's, I think, an important insight. There's an important insight there that, takes some effort to be a good person. not naturally so, in a certain way, not naturally so. In Christian tradition, which builds on the Jewish tradition, also this idea that, you know, people have this nature. Jewish people didn't really have a concept of original sin. That's an invention of Saint Augustine, a Christian thing. But this idea that humans have this tendency is, I think, an important insight. Now, in Buddhism, there isn't this concept of sin. It's ignorance. People have like basic ignorance. It's like we get a little too caught up in something, and then we begin to be not so good, not so kind. And it's important, I think, to understand this elemental aspect of ignorance. I was driving up to Hackettstown the other day, and I have a radio in my car. We have a sit in Hackettstown in the morning, and I turn on the radio and listen to NPR on my way up. I listen at like 6 o'clock in the morning or something. And I heard a song that was just so beautiful. It was just so wonderful that I was stunned by it. And I wish I could play it for you now. I can't. But I can tell you that it's archived. If you go out to your computer, there's a site called All Songs Considered. It's part of the All Things Considered network. And you can type in All Songs Considered. And there's this beautiful song by this Hawaiian singer whose name is Israel Kamakawa. I'm not going to pronounce his last name. Israel Kamakawa Wiwa Ole. Kamakawa Wiwa Ole. Israel Kamakawa Wiwa Ole. That should be easy to remember. But he's going to be the only Kamakawa Wiwa Ole on the page. And if you do go out to the site, it's All Songs Considered. Be prepared, I think. You know, everybody appreciates things differently. So you might listen to it and think, oh, I don't know why that meant so much to him. But for me, hearing that song was really wrenching. And part of it was the insight, the insights in what he sang. And part of it was the way he sang it. Because his way of singing is so gentle, and there's a bit of pain. You can hear a bit. My feeling was when I listened to this person, this is somebody who has had a rough life, and he's become very gentle and kind. But he knows that life is tough, you know, and has this great insight. And later, after the sit, in the afternoon, I did some research on Israel Kamakawa Wiwa Ole. And it does indeed turn out that he had kind of a tragic life. He is a native Hawaiian, as you might have guessed from the name. And if you know anything about Hawaiians, they've had a very difficult history in the last 200 years. In Hawaii today, Hawaiians, native Hawaiians, are the poorest people on the islands. And they feel very disenfranchised, very much victims of unfair events. And they have been. You know, they're the poorest people in Hawaii. It was their island, right? And it was taken from them. And like the Native Americans, they went through a long process of being culturally undermined. So for a while, the government tried to eliminate their culture and their language. And most of their land is gone. And of course, they have high rates of alcoholism and so on. See, this is actually a rather typical human story, unfortunately. And so he grew up in that environment. And lately, the Hawaiians have tried to recover some of their culture. They've tried to revive some of their music and this dance and some of their stories, their ancient stories, food and other kinds of art forms, trying to recover their path. The song he sang isn't a Hawaiian song, but he sings it in the Hawaiian style, actually with a ukulele. And it's just beautiful, in my opinion, really deeply moving, because I could hear so much of this I could hear something like this in his voice. And song itself was really two parts. It was a medley, we said. The first part was one song, and the second part was the second song. And these two songs sort of speak to each other in a way that I think is very, very important, really gets at fundamental human dilemma. You know, both the wonder of being a human and the problem of being a human. And the first song, I think you'll recognize. And I'm definitely not, he does such a beautiful job, I wouldn't even dream of trying to sing it. But it goes like this. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where my troubles melt like lemon drops, away above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over the rainbow. Why can't I? Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops, away above the chimney tops, that's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over the rainbow. Why, oh why can't I? If happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow, why, oh why can't I? See, I think that's a beautiful song. And I think it's a very profound statement. I can imagine how much that song meant to somebody like Israel, growing up on the streets of Honolulu, and maybe his dad had a drinking problem. And I should tell you also that Israel had a serious weight problem. He actually died of renal failure and his lungs collapsed, because he was one of these people you read about who weighs like 1,000 pounds. Right? I didn't know any of this, of course, when I heard this beautiful song on the radio. But, this is part of like a mental world people fall into. In Buddhism, we would say like a hell realm. Yeah? He couldn't get out of that hell realm all his life, and finally died. You know? This is a mental world that we can fall into. Right? You can understand it. Tremendous injustice, right? And must have had a really difficult life. And could not escape from his problems. Yeah. And in that condition, you know, we want so much to be over the, you know, it's like the whole being says, let me out of this world. Let me out of this terrible world. This is so much a part of our nature. And I think the thing is, I would like to suggest that when we do that, in a way, you know, it's so much of our art and culture, so many things we create express that longing to get out of here. And it's so understandable. But it's also the source of our misery. It's not a good medicine for us. It's a part of who we are, but I personally think that it just makes us sicker. I mean, in my family, people have a history of alcoholism, as a matter of fact. I mean, this is so common. It's a, you know, very common. You know, my father had a serious drinking problem, and my grandfather had a serious drinking problem, and probably his father. And I myself don't drink at all, you know, for obvious reasons. And I can think of all the times, you know, I think people, you know, drink because they want to, over the rainbow, please, you know, get me over the rainbow. And you know, all of our illusions, in a way, I feel, in a way, that humans surround themselves with the illusion of being over the rainbow. This is tied in with, like, so many of our dreams and aspirations, but it's kind of medicine that makes us sicker. And maybe Israel, Kamakawa Wiwa Ole, actually understood this, I think. This song was one of the last things he did in his life. Because after he gets to the end of Over the Rainbow, if happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow, why oh why can't I? The song moves in a different direction, and there's a, or the medley moves in a different direction, and there's another song, see, and you'll probably recognize this one too. I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies crying. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world. And there's a rainbow here too, but these are like very different, seems to me. Over the rainbow and right here now. See, right here now. Right here, this moment. Human beings secrete dreams. When human beings are frightened or unhappy or disappointed, they secrete dreams the way oysters secrete a shell around them. This is like our protective mechanism. Somewhere over the rainbow, somewhere over the rainbow, somewhere. And actually, the more we do this, the more, I think, unhappy we become. And humans think they're sane, but they're not. we live in a world which is actually almost insane a lot of the time. If you watch the news and you see about Iraq, you just have to say sometimes, you know, this is absolute madness. How did we ever do this, right? Well, we had some very rational reasons at some point, but it becomes like a weird dreamscape, right? So dreams are important and part of the richness of human life, but we get very, very lost in our dreams. And it seems to me that it becomes very difficult to find a way out. You know, how do I get out of here? How do I get out of here? In the Wizard of Oz, what Dorothy does is a witch tells her, you just have to click your shoes, you know, you're going to go home. And, you know, she wanted to get away from home, but Oz is even weirder and more dangerous than home, right? The Buddha said, actually, that it is possible to wake up from our dreams. It's possible. You're not lost endlessly in dream. But there's a way out of dream. And it's so simple. It takes a lot of work, but it's so simple. It's what the Buddha taught was being here now. Being here now. This is all he ever taught, was being here now. Bring the mind back to this moment now. You know, it doesn't matter what Heidegger said or Hegel. It doesn't matter what policy wonks in Washington think. It doesn't matter. None of this is real. All of this is like the dream, the maze of dreams in which humans live. And at times it seems absolutely inescapable. And at those moments we can be abjectly unhappy. We build these dream kingdoms thinking they're going to make us happy. And I believe that at the end of it, we become desperately unhappy. But Buddha said there's a way, Siddhartha Shakyamuni said, you know, there's a way out and it's right at your disposal now. It's be here now. Sit on the cushion. You watch the breath and the dreams just explode across the screen of your mind, right? When you come back to your breath and the dreams, you know, the fearful dreams and the beautiful dreams. And the tension creating dreams and the sadness creating dreams, you know, you come back to the breath and back to the breath and back to the breath. Little by little. You know, this is so important. We're so lucky that it is possible to escape from these terrible dreams. And you come to the breath, you come to the breath, you come back to the breath, and back to the breath, and back to the breath. And you get up, and I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Skies of blue and clouds of white. This is right here in front of us. Right? Skies of blue and clouds of white. Every human being, you know, the bright, blessed day and the dark, sacred night. Somebody asked a Dogen Zenji, what did you learn in Zen? He said, I learned that, you know, my nose is in front of my face, my ears are on the side of my head. This is our deliverance. This is our deliverance. And how lucky we are. Once in the old days, in the time of the world-honored one, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Bring her out of her dreams and ask her herself. Ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers, took her up to Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of her dreams, but in vain. The world-honored one said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot wake her up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there's a bodhisattva named Momyo. He will arouse her from her samadhi. Instantly, Momyo jumps out of the earth, right here, right now. Made a bow, goes up to the girl and wakes her up." This Momyo is right here and now. It's the most wonderful thing. Old Shakyamuni put on a petty drama and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he rouse the girl from her samadhi? The answer's right here in front of us. How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. Everything is Buddha. Everything is Buddha. Everything. Mumon's verse, one was successful, the other was not. Those are dreams. Right? Both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil mask. Success and failure, beauty and ugliness, you know, wealth and poverty, these are actually all dreams. All dreams. Even in defeat, a beautiful performance, everything is good. Everything. Happy New Year. Sujo muhen segando
Om namujin segandam Om namujo segandam Sujo mujo segandjo Sujo muhen segando Thank you.
our next Saturday sit will be at the end of January, 2 weeks after the end of Sesshin.
I'll just go around.